محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Systemic terrorism continues in the occupied territories as Zionist settler colonialists wreak more havoc against Palestinians. Armed settlers opened fire indiscriminately and burned homes and vehicles. More Palestinians were attacked, crops and land burned, all under the protection of the Zionist military. This is being done while the Zionists are trying to usurp more Palestinian lands with their expansion of illegal settlements. And, of course, this apartheid regime is continually allowed to operate with terrorism as its modus operandi, as a so-called international community does nothing. Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson, Masar Badil Movement, out of Vancouver. Zafar Bangash, Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off in Vancouver. And Khaled, I mean, why do you think that we're seeing an increase of the settler violence and on an almost daily basis, at least one Palestinian being killed by regime forces?
Well, I think that what's happening today in Palestine is we are witnessing in daily attacks by Israeli settlers with the full protection and cover of the Israeli Zionist army. Now, it's very important to understand that these settlers are basically paramilitary and mercenaries. Most of them, they come from New York and Berlin, Paris, cities in the West. They are continuing the Israeli settler project in Palestine as it was founded, 75 years ago and even before that. When we look at who actually established the settler colonialist regime of Israel, it was settlers, just like the one in the West Bank and in all of Palestine, really, because we do not differentiate between colonies in the West Bank and colonies in Al-Naqab, for example, or in Haifa. The nature of this regime is based on a settler colonialist nature, and what guides settler is a theme: more land and less Arabs. They want to grab more land and they want to see less Palestinians in Palestine. And this is a systematic policy that Israel uses in order to actually push Palestinians on the policy they call slowly transfer, which means not just building settlements and colonies in the West Bank, but also evacuate more Palestinians. We see this goes hand in hand. When you look at Israeli bulldozers, destroying Palestinian homes, you will see the same bulldozers building Israeli colonies. So this is very important to see. We also need to understand that this is completely a business and profit for Israeli companies who are complicit in this basically the industry of settlements, because they give Israeli companies all kind of contracts in order to. So everyone is actually complicit in this, whether the Israeli government, whether the settler organizations, or whether the Zionist movement in Europe and in North America, with full protection of U.S. government and European government. Mm-hmm. And this entire system shows clearly the nature of Israel as a colonialist settler project.
Okay, well, I want to touch on part of what you said a little bit later about the support system coming out of Europe and North America. But let me get Zafar involved in this conversation. Zionist settlers have defiled Hamas, entering it with a dog and even tearing up Qurans. And this shows their sheer hatred and racism against Muslims, against Palestinians in general. So I want to talk about the lack of condemnation. We always hear about religious tolerance and respect, especially coming out of the Canadian capital or United States or England. So what's going on here? Why is it a different framework when it comes to the Palestinians?
Well, I think we need to be clear about the fact that because Zionist Israel is a colonial settler entity, and the vast majority of people that are involved in this colonial enterprise, they are from North America, including Canada and Europe, and they are the kith and kin of these people. And that's why no crime that Israel perpetrates, whether it's the so-called settlers, in fact, we should not call them settlers, they are illegal squatters, or the Zionist army, or its police forces, they are all involved in this enterprise of ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people from their lands. And for the Palestinians, the Nakba has not ended. It occurred 75 years ago, but it's been continuing now as well for the last 75 years. And what these so-called settlers have demonstrated is that they have no regard whatsoever for the sentiments of the Palestinian people. They barge into mosques, including Masjid al-Aqsa, which is the third holiest place for the Muslims. They barge in with their filthy boots. They take, you know, in this latest attack that they carried out, there were dogs that were taken into the mosque, and they tore copies of the Quran. And as you asked as to why there is silence in the West, it is because these criminals that are involved in these activities are kith and kin of the West. And the West in general, and the United States in particular, wants to continue to have turmoil in that region, because it then helps in their arms sales to that region, because Zionist Israel continues to create instability. So there are two aspects to it. One is the internal situation in Palestine, and the other is the external dimension of support that is provided to the Zionist criminal enterprise of colonial settlers. Internally, of course, the Israelis keep on pushing the Palestinians out of their land by killing them, by ethnically cleansing them. You know, for instance, in the West Bank, there are something like 600,000 to 700,000 illegal squatters in the West Bank, and they usurp the overwhelming majority of the choicest land, of water. In fact, 90% of the water in the West Bank is utilized by these 600,000 to 700,000 Zionist squatters, whereas the only 10% of the water of the West Bank is left for about 2.8 million Palestinians. So one can begin to see that this entire project is based upon ethnically cleansing the Palestinians of their land. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have these external powers, the Europeans, with the exception of perhaps Ireland, that has been supportive of the Palestinian cause, but the United States in particular, that pumps in billions of dollars into this parasitical state to continue its aggressive policies. And any crime that they commit, these people remain completely silent, because that is exactly what they want. They don't care about others' rights. They don't care about the Palestinians' rights. They don't care about religion or anything. It's just that this advances the West's agenda in that region as well.
Well, Khaled, we've heard some statements by Israeli security chiefs this time around, actually calling the settler attacks on Palestinian villages as nationalist terrorism. So your thoughts about that? Why do you think this time around they have actually condemned it in this way?
Well, I think, you know, they're trying to play bad cop, good cop kind of policy. But Netanyahu, it's just like he's just like Ben Gafir. It's just the other coin of Ben Gafir. And the government today in Israel is the only thing that it's keeping it intact is the forces that represent the settlers project, particularly Ben Gafir, Smotrich and others. And we see that these open calls from Israeli ministers to, he said, even if we have to kill thousands, basically this is the same phrases that settlers in Palestine in the 30s and 40s used when they committed hundreds of massacres that led to a Nakba of 1948 and the displacement of the vast majority of the Palestinian people. What they want to do now is to, as your guest said, that a Nakba did not stop and it's continuing. And what they want to do is to create another major catastrophe for the Palestinian people by pushing Palestinians to leave their villages. These settlers, when you look at these settlements, every Palestinian village today in the West Bank is surrounded by three or four settlements right on the hills of the West Bank and the mountains looking down at Palestinian villages and towns. And they feel that they can actually displace Palestinians from the West Bank. And they say that publicly, that if they want, they can go to Jordan. And we see, for example, today the United States said that they are going to seize some of the funds that they provide for organizations in the settlements, which means that the United States actually fund settlers and settlements, mm-hmm. and they have been doing so. And now they're just kind of trying to practice some pressure for media consumptions. But what it actually says is that the United States provide material support for these paramilitary gangs that they call themselves, you know, settlers. They mm-hmm. are, when you look at any Israeli colony or settlement in the West Bank, what they have there is a military training camp. They have a prison. They have, arsenal. They're well-trained, military-trained. And some of them served in the Canadian forces, the United States forces, French forces, German army, and many of them don't even speak Hebrew. That's why they're kind of mercenaries and they're paramilitary and they act like a shield for the Zionist project. And that's why the Palestinian resistance said any settler in the West Bank or in Palestine is a legitimate target for the Palestinian resistance. These settlers are a legitimate target for the Palestinian resistance because they are worse than even the organized Israeli army. The other thing that Israel depends on settlers to carry crimes because there is no one to blame. And they can always say, well, it's not the government of Israel who did this. It's settlements who are settlers who are angry. And basically, they're trying to play a complementary role, the army and the settlers, in terms of attacking Palestinians and achieving the goals of the Zionist project. Now, I think they are failing miserably because Palestinians are not going anywhere. And Palestinians, even under the most harsh conditions in Gaza, under 15 years of siege, the Palestinian resistance is growing and the Palestinian people are not leaving Palestine. They know, Palestinians, they understand that they must be steadfast. They must uphold to their land, their farms, their villages and towns. And they feel that this is not just a battle between them and the Israeli settlers or the Zionist regime, but they feel, Palestinians feels that they are the forefront for the Arab and Muslim nations and for the people of the region.
Okay.
And so they have a responsibility to be steadfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, what about that, Zafar? Because well, we have seen some mixed statements coming out of the Israeli regime, as I had mentioned, about the security chiefs and trying to basically condemn some of these settlement attacks. Do you think that that's because of fear? I mean, Khalid has just talked about the resistance and how steadfast the resistance is. And of course, they're expecting blowback as they have become more and more violent against the Palestinians over the last several weeks. Do you think the fear factor is part of it? While we're trying, sometimes we see this sort of a good cop, bad cop act with them, actually security chiefs of all people, sort of condemning this as national terrorism. Or how do you see it, Zafar?
Well, there is no doubt that they are playing this good cop, bad cop routine in order to deflect criticism from the Zionist regime. But as you know, your guest pointed out that the Zionist regime is supporting these settlers. They are, you know, they have served in the military. They continue to serve. They have weapons, etc. So that's one dimension of it. Although I would say that, yes, there is no doubt that there is a fear factor involved, because despite the extreme brutalities of the Zionist occupiers for more than 75 years, they have not been able to subdue the Palestinian people. In fact, to the great credit of the Palestinian people, they're totally, virtually unarmed. And yet they are able to resist these criminal Zionist terrorists with virtually nothing in their hands. And they're able to face these barbarians and are still able to inflict some punishment upon them. It is important to keep in mind that under international law, people under occupation have the right to resist their occupiers by whatever means necessary. This has been repeatedly enunciated by United Nations General Assembly resolutions, not Security Council resolutions, regrettably, because any time such resolutions come before the Security Council, the United States is there to veto these resolutions, so Israel is protected. But the General Assembly, which represents the will of the international community, of 193 countries, has on two occasions stated quite categorically that people under occupation have the right to resist their occupiers. And we have seen this resistance growing stronger, not only in the tiny Gaza Strip, which is besieged, but also in Jenin and in Nablus and now in other areas. I mean, it is to the immense credit of the Palestinian people that they have not surrendered to the Zionist terrorist campaign. In fact, it's a test of will between the Palestinians and the Zionists. And to their great credit, the Palestinians have shown themselves to be extremely courageous. And I would like to add that it is now up to the rest of the Muslim world, the Muslims around the world, that they should not only simply express solidarity with the suffering Palestinian people, but to provide them material support so that they can continue to resist these Zionist criminals and drive them out of Palestine and enforce a system whereby all the people, Palestinians, whether they are Muslims or Christians, as well as Jews who are the original, those who were there originally in Palestine, they can live as equal citizens under the law, not these alien invaders from Europe, North America, etc., that have inundated that land and are basically killing innocent Palestinians, particularly children. I mean, when you look at the statistics, it's horrendous. This year alone, in 2023 up to the present time, more than 170 Palestinians have been killed. That includes 30 children.
Yes.
And in fact, you know, some Israeli writers have written about it, UC Klein and, you know, in the Haaretz, etc. But unfortunately for these Zionist criminals, Palestinian lives do not matter. And therefore, the Palestinians are forced to resist the occupiers. And that has put fear of God into the minds of these people.
Well, Khaled, what do you think it's going to take? I mean, Zafar talked about the 193 members of the General Assembly and how the majority of them actually, more and more, they're being very vocal about actually the Palestinian situation. But of course, at the end of the day, it's the Security Council in the United States or UK that vetoes whatever they want to do against the Israeli regime. But we are seeing from the Global South, from different parts of the world, from Africa, from West Asia, more and more support for the Palestinian cause. What is it going to take to actually, on the international level, then break this control by these Western regimes in support of Tel Aviv in order to actually force the hand of that regime?
Well, I think that the United Nations and the international, so-called international community, they have issued hundreds of resolutions calling for Israel to stop settlements, calling for not to expand settlements, considering the apartheid wall to be illegal, and all that. But the problem is that these international resolutions does not have any teeth when it comes to Israel, because, as you mentioned, the United States veto is ready to defuse any kind of real international efforts. We know that the United States used its veto power, over 45 times throughout the conflict. Anytime that Israel needs a protection on the international level, you are going to see Germany, France, Britain, United States, Australia supporting Israel, including Canada. And now, that, why is that? Why is also these particular countries like U.S., Canada, and, is because these are colonialist powers as well. Mm-hmm. Canada is a settler colonialist state, and it doesn't want anyone to remind the world that what Israel is doing.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson, Masar Badel Movement out of Vancouver. Zafar Bangash, director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto. And as always, it's a pleasure having you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Back to reality again. You're listening to Higher Arab English Radio. Today, I have the honor to be in this episode of Back to Reality. And with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Dawood and Brother Mehdi. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Assalamu alaikum. I am Dawood, and I am very happy to be at your service.
Alaikum assalam.
Could you please introduce yourself briefly for me and the listeners?
Hello everyone, I'm Mehdi. I'm here in Qum for the last 6 years studying the seminary.
Thank you. And Brother Dawood?
Assalamu alaikum.
Salam.
I am Dawood and I have been teaching English for over 25 years, and I've got MA in TEFL, Teaching English as a Foreign Language.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to have you both in here. So, as you know, we talked about the concept of happiness in the last episode. Mm-hmm. And we got to this point that we have two different categories of happiness, as Brother David mentioned. And the first one is superficial happiness, and the other one is the self-satisfaction within yourself. But here, I want to open another door. If we imagine that we have two these categories of happiness, but still there is something missing here, you know.
Right.
Another thing which I think is the main happiness, you know, I think the other two categories is somehow the definitions that we are making in this world. They are some materialistic. And another level of happiness is related to the satisfaction of God, you know. We need a kind of higher level of connection with someone which is higher than us to feel we have something, to just not to feel empty. And I think this is the real happiness, which we have to relate it to God.
The way you phrased it, I will never agree with that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Why? Because the way you phrased it,
yeah,
is precisely how an atheist would target theists.
Thank you to make me an atheist.
Right? No. I'm saying this is precisely how atheists would target theists.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know what? Most of the theists who are dependent in their satisfaction on another
person,
higher being, are out of two people. Either they are lacking the motivation, they do not want to go through the struggle of life, they want to ignore the struggle of life, they don't want to face the realities of life, and what they do they resort to a higher being for their satisfaction, and they label this as sort of an escapism from reality. And secondly, it's just people who have no achievement in the world, nothing in the world, and what they say is, well, you know, I've got nothing. At least I've got heaven. So they've got nothing in this world, right? So if you're like, listen, for me to not feel empty, I have to have a higher being. If you phrase it like that, then
it's going to be targeted.
You know, and it's rightfully so. If we phrase it like that and we target it, it's rightfully so. We have the right to be targeted if we phrase it like that.
Yeah.
You know? Like, well, you know, because I'm hollow, I need a God. Well, no.
So, you know, that could be the right phrase. Let's keep it
all right,
after a short break. Thank you, dear listeners. Welcome back. We were talking about the right phrasing of and just needing not to be empty. Yeah, Brother.
Right. So what I'm saying is what we need to do at the first step is identify what you feel.
Yeah.
Identify. Not saying that what you said was wrong, right? But we need to identify the fact that how long does the sense of satisfaction that is seen in the world as sought after last. So we need to dissect that kind of satisfaction in the first place, right? If you wanted a degree, you wanted your PhD, for example. Brother David wanted his PhD, right? He's achieved it now. Now what?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That sense of satisfaction or achievement that you had, right? Not for anyone else. For yourself. Even for yourself, right? You wanted a PhD for yourself to gain knowledge in, for example, what? Quantum physics. You understand? Right? You got it. Now what? How long does that sense of achievement last? Now, if that doesn't last for long, right, usually it doesn't. It might last for a year. And I'm being extravagant over here, saying that a degree causes you a year of happiness, right? If it's not connected to other things, for example, you got your degree and as a result of your degree, you got a job which got you a Ferrari. No, I'm not saying that. Just the degree itself.
Mm-hmm.
How long does the effect of achievement in that degree last? Doesn't last a year. As I said, at most a year, say 2 years, right?
Yeah.
Why the question is, like, I'm going to throw out an open question over here. Why is it? Nah, this is how we put forth.
Yeah, you know, I got it.
Why? Why is it that these kinds of achievements that often people spend lifetimes seeking, the achievements, these yeah. happiness, this happiness is as temporary as yes. a few years.
Yeah.
Why?
Doesn't last long.
Yeah,
no.
yeah, exactly. Why?
So why is it like that? It means that, I mean, it's something better. You know, and maybe I'm phrasing it in a way that may seem like kind of confusing and confounding, but the meaning is that we need something higher and more permanent and something which lasts longer, you know, and it will define happiness in a better way. And the thing which I want to go through is the relation of the religion we have, especially Islam, and the happiness, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to lead us more towards the meaning of happiness and the answer of the question you actually mentioned, why. So let's answer this question, why, related to the Islamic content and concept of happiness. Yeah, Brother Dawood?
Yes, we have just one true sense of happiness, but it can or it may have many forms or manifestations. Like probably someone who feels like he gets a degree and that degree would remain a kind or a level of happiness for him. However, it doesn't last long, as you mentioned, my brother. You said you have to identify your feeling, you have to identify yourself to realize what sort of happiness. Happiness is an end, perhaps, to me, personally speaking. And I feel like my education is a means to reach that end, because from the Islamic point of view, I always feel like, because of my family religious background, I was raised in a religious family where my mom mostly was teaching me the concept of happiness is within my spiritual uplifting. Knowing yourself or knowing oneself is knowing Allah or God. You know, you feel spiritually elevated or exalted in case you grasp the real sense of happiness, and this is to be in peace with you. How can you remain peaceful within you? It is the time when you are feeling spiritually elevated, and this is the real sense of happiness. But
no, actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. That's actually a very good point. You know why? Because a lot of people who are atheists have a problem with this. Right? And I think I'm going to straight. You guys are jealous, atheists out there. You guys are jealous. Why? Because they don't have this kind of satisfaction that religious people do. They're like, oh, look at these people living in their own bubble, not worried about anything, you know? Why? Why are you being so bothered, right? Because they see that satisfaction that they've been craving for and yet failed to achieve. And someone, some average guy, average Joe, with nothing in his hand in terms of worldly properties, achievements, is like twice or thrice as happy as any person who's not.
I know you have a nice point of view that you're telling me that you're jealous of this because they cannot achieve it. Sometimes even we as, I don't know, some just simple individuals, we feel like maybe our way is somehow imaginary. You know what I mean? I mean that their kind of accent, tellings from this jealousy will mislead us. You know, it's like, you know, we are some kind of religious people that we find this happiness in some spiritual parts of our aspects of our life, you know? And when they underestimate it in a bad way, and we know, still we know
what's
that.
What's underestimated?
The people that cannot find this happiness in spiritual aspects, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they will underestimate us, and we may feel lost for a moment even. And I think this feeling is, we have to work on that, you know? Sometimes, as you told, you have a kind of family background, Brother David mentioned, you know? Sometimes we have to delete this family background and we have to look through it ourselves, you know? And we have to step in this road to find the real happiness, you know what I mean? I mean that if this spiritual sense that you have is something that you are coping from someone, it's not going to work. You have to find it yourself. This is what I mean. And as
find
you told,
you
they
found,
mean
the happiness.
Yeah, the happiness, the spiritual happiness. Sometimes you just feel a connection with God because you were born in a family that has a connection with God, you know?
Okay.
And the thing I mean is that we have to do something about it. We have to go through it. We have to walk. Happiness is not going to come to you by your background. You know, this is
okay.
What I mean.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
As I have already mentioned, the real sense of happiness is when we define what really makes us happy. Probably, I told you in my dichotomy of happiness from outside, well, you are comparing yourself to be more successful compared to others. We have nothing to do with that. And another form of happiness is within you. I can give it another term. Passive versus real happiness. A passive happiness is something that may have a short life. You feel content with your educational success, achievement, like you got a degree, but it doesn't last long, as you mentioned. But when you remain peaceful with you, when you feel like you are bringing yourself to your real identity, when you find yourself, you have discovered yourself. According to my religious background, which cannot be easily elaborated in words, you know, we were raised in a religious family. We cannot simply talk about these basic terms with someone like who is atheist and who probably feels like I am in a bubble of happiness. It has nothing to do with their feelings because I'm not experiencing that level. However, some people would say that it is better to start from an atheism to reach your monotheism level to understand and to discover God. But above all, I mentioned that when I am knowing myself, when I am in peace with myself, it is the time that I feel a better level of elevation, and that is when I am reaching
in your happiness,
in my exaltation in my spiritual feelings, and that is what this item is taught to me by my religion.
So, of course, there is a deeper meaning for that. And Brother Mehdi, if you have just a short sentence to end and wrap all the things up.
It can't be short, so I'm just going to let it go on this note that if we go into the discussion of God himself, then we're going to get off track. So, yeah, basically, there's an idiom in Arabic. It says, تُعْرَفُ الْأَشْيَاءُ بِأَضْدَادِهَا. Things are identified by their polar opposites, right? Mm. And Allah says, مَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي فَإِنَّ لَهُ مَعِيشَةً ضَنْكَ. Right, whoever is away from my remembrance, does not remember me, has got a life of humiliation. So, yeah, if you look at that, this is the polar opposite. What is going to be the polar opposite of humiliation is that satisfaction and grace which lies in the remembrance of Allah.
Thank you. Thank you, dear brothers, for being here with me. I want to end this episode with this beautiful quote from the Holy Quran. Ala bi zikri Allahi tatma'innul qulub. You know, only the remembrance of Allah in every moment of your life, no matter you may define it as sad or happy, will help you to maintain your sanity, maintain your happiness, and your inner peace, as you both mentioned. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Like the rest of the Muslim nations, people in Pakistan are celebrating Eid al-Adha, an important religious festival on the Islamic calendar, which marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Eid al-Adha, also known as the Feast of Sacrifice in the Muslim world, is a joyful and vibrant event marked by sacrificing animals, sharing the meat with family, friends, and the needy. Mosques and public places were packed with people celebrating the auspicious occasion. The day was observed with special prayers and acts of charity that promote a sense of community, unity, and gratitude among people. On this joyful occasion, Muslims commemorate Prophet Ibrahim's submission to the divine order of sacrificing his son.
Eid al-Adha make the day when Prophet Ibrahim was proud to have passed the divine test, obeyed the divine order, and been chosen as the leader and role model for the believers in Islam. Eid al-Adha is the purest expression of worship as well as a sign of sacrifice and surrender to God Almighty.
Days before the auspicious occasion, special livestock markets were established in all cities and towns across the country, where thousands of animals were brought to be sold for the sacrificial event. However, due to the worsening economic situation in the country, there was a large downturn in sales.
This year it is very hard to perform one of the very important religious obligations, that is the ritual of sacrifice, due to skyrocketing inflation and price hikes. The prices of the animals, clothes and shoes have doubled compared to the prices of previous year.
On this Eid, we used to distribute the meat of sacrificial animals among the needy and the poor, who cannot afford to buy meat, and they could join us in the celebrations of this special event.
Besides meeting and greeting, inviting loved ones for the meal and holding barbecue parties are among the main traditions of Eid al-Adha in Pakistan. Hosting barbecue parties on such holidays has become a growing trend in recent years, where relatives and friends are invited to have fun and enjoy delicious meals prepared from sacrificial meat.
Eid al-Adha is a festival that not only provides Muslims with the opportunity to reflect on the virtues of sacrifice, obedience and appreciation, but also gives people a great chance to get together, share meals, exchange gifts and extend acts of kindness to each other. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On Tuesday in the Italian capital, a string of left-leaning groups and anti-war associations organized a demonstration dubbed Stop Sending Weapons in protest against Italy's government's relentless support for Ukraine. Rome has so far approved 7 military support packages to Kyiv, including both lethal and non-lethal equipment, for over 1 billion euros. Italians have repeatedly expressed their opposition to sending weapons to Ukraine, but their calls have so far gone utterly unheard by successive governments.
We have a serious problem in Italy. The majority of the people are deeply against the war. All surveys have been showing that, and yet these people haven't been able to get together in an association or group Everybody has to know that the government's decisions go against the will of the people.
I think everybody understood that this very war will not have a winner. Sending weapons will, the only effect will produce is longer war.
Italy's support to Ukraine hasn't only translated into sending military equipment. Last month, Italy's defense minister Guido Crosetto announced that Rome will deploy some 3,400 of its troops on NATO's eastern flank by the end of this year. Italy has been a staunch supporter of Ukraine since day one of the conflict with Russia. Recently, Italy's foreign minister Antonio Tajani has hinted at creating a NATO-Ukraine council at the upcoming Atlantic Alliance's summit, which will be held in Lithuania next week.
Clearly, this proposal by the Italian minister Tajani only serves the purpose of extending the duration of the war, which is in contrast with the desire of the Italians. They want peace, and I find it very positive that Cardinal Matteo Zuppi is in Moscow for a two-day peace mission.
The Holy See has sent the president of the Italian Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Matteo Maria Zuppi, as its envoy to Moscow to foster dialogue and seek a peaceful solution to the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit will end on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
Tehran has hosted an international conference on reviewing the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Iran's Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, said that dozens of documents against U.S. sanctions have been prepared to counter such measures.
The U.S. administration used every illegitimate means to achieve its sinister goal and sought to destroy the Iranian government by putting pressure on the Iranian people. In the field of sanctions, a heavy case has been prepared against the U.S. Dozens of documents against these sanctions have been prepared, and every measure is taken to counter the sanctions against Iran.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize an issue, and this is exactly what the United States has done.
America's actions are not consistent with the commitments made in the 1948 Covenants and Declaration and other human rights documents. U.S. authorities have proven that wherever their legitimate interests and national interests require, they leave human rights documents aside, and whenever they want to oppress other governments, people, and societies, they act upon the claims of human rights violation.
The American Human Rights Week occasion in Iran marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, or the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran Islamic Republic Party. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast.
U.S. government tries to portray itself as a great savior for the world, which is really just a big lie or a great deception, because we have seen, especially since September 11th, that the U.S. has killed many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and has also made probably more than a million people, or maybe even more than 2 million people inside of the greater Middle East region. It's the U.S. government has made these people homeless.
People here say that the American version of human rights is a jab at Washington to question its dual take on human rights and to expose it to the world.
The participants believe that terrorism and sanctions are the main pillars of the American version of human rights, in the absence of which the U.S. will not be able to continue its hegemony dominance and plots across the globe. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
At shops and markets across the U.K., there's only one big topic of conversation these days: inflation. The rate at which prices are rising is taking its toll. For well over a year now, prices have been rising at the fastest rate in decades. Each trip to the shop is getting worse and worse for those who can least afford it.
Perhaps this right here illustrates how bad things are. A pretty standard shop of white bread, milk, butter, and flour. About a year ago, around $9 for the whole thing. Today, around $15, and that excludes energy and rent.
And while prices have soared, incomes haven't, forcing public workers to take to the streets demanding better pay over the past year. There are all sorts of reasons for the inflation, the high energy costs, the COVID bounce back. But there's also a very UK-specific explanation.
It's called Brexit, and that's red tape, that's delays, that's the need for certification and bureaucracy. Supply chains have got disrupted, and that pushes up the price of food. And, of course, a tighter labour market also, because we don't get all those EU workers coming in, you know, that help produce, you know, cheap food for the British people.
Another sign of the times, more people falling on hard times. This food bank in northwest London, one of the tens of thousands across the nation, has seen a surge in the number of people asking for help.
We've certainly noticed an increase in demand this year compared to last year because of the cost of living crisis. In fact, we've had to change our food bank policy because we were consistently giving out 300 food parcels a week for the past few months, and we're unable to keep up with the demand. And we can see that the guests we're supporting are really struggling with the cost of basic essentials.
The UK government has promised to have inflation in the next year, but those already on the brink say they cannot afford to wait. Saeed Pourreza, London.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers met on Monday to discuss the latest developments pertaining to the war in Ukraine. They suggest that the Wagner Group's armed mutiny in Russia last Saturday represents a risk because of the Federation's nuclear weapons. It's claimed the Kremlin has been weakened.
First, it was a threat because it was strong, it has force, and now it's becoming a risk because it may have entering in an era of political instability and internal fragility.
Putin claims Kiev and its Western masters wanted Russians to kill each other. Without mentioning Wagner's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, directly, Putin says the organisers of the mutiny betrayed their country. Experts have been sharing their thoughts with us.
Putin is in full control, as we have seen, and everything that was released by the mainstream media and all the politicians who are anti-Russia and supporting the war were merely expressing only their wishful thinking.
EU foreign affairs ministers have rubber-stamped an 11th package of sanctions against Russia. Many lawmakers, analysts, and even the Hungarian government say efforts to try and pressure Putin have backfired. Energy sanctions in particular have led to a cost-of-living crisis across Europe. Eurozone interest rates continue to rise. This is putting enormous strain on millions of households and businesses. Despite EU-funded investigations prior to the war revealing corruption problems at every level within Ukraine society, the 27-nation bloc continues to send billions of euro to the country. Massive amounts of deadly Western arms arrive into Ukraine every day. EU leaders are due to hold a summit this Thursday and Friday here in the Belgian capital. The war in Ukraine will dominate proceedings. If previous summits are anything to go by, do not expect a single reference to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims have arrived at Mount Arafat to perform one of the final rituals of this year's Hajj pilgrimage. It is on this day that pilgrims spend the day praying, reciting the Quran, and repenting until sunset. The day is called Arafat, and the act is known as Wuquf.
Yes, I pray for all Muslims that may Allah grant them.
The significance of this place is that it was here that the Holy Prophet of Islam delivered his last sermon. He called on Muslims to uphold human dignity, respect women's rights, uphold economic equality, avoid discrimination, and be faithful to the teachings of Islam.
Muslims should unite. Islamic unity is a necessity, but unfortunately, Muslims have different views.
Another event that takes place on Arafat is called the Disavowal of Polytheists. Pilgrims took part in this ceremony in which a message by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out.
The political aspect of the Hajj is even more important than its spiritual aspect.
The two main points of the message were unity and spirituality. He called on Muslims to use the opportunity of Hajj to get to know each other and strengthen ties in all aspects. He also pointed out that the West, specifically the U.S. and Israel, are against the unity of Muslims.
All the actions and rituals performed by the pilgrims are all intended to show Muslim unity, equality, and spiritual revelation, among other things. Vahid Tahami, Mount Arafat.
A better future for digital economy. This is what the 26th edition of the International Electronic Computer and E-commerce Exhibition, dubbed ELECOMP, promises its visitors this year. After a hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic, state-of-the-art electronic technologies are once again on display in Tehran, offering a glimpse at what the country has to offer in this field, particularly with the activities of knowledge-based companies gaining momentum over the past couple of years.
This is a corridor presenting all the knowledge-based products of Iran. There are more than 1,200 knowledge-based high-tech products presented in 15 different sections here. It is actually a favorable place to visit for foreign delegations traveling to Iran.
This is in line with the current administration's short and midterm plans for the digital economy to thrive. The exhibition is also laying the groundwork for a forum of ICT ministers of eco-countries to be held next month in Tehran.
Regional countries are the main customers of our products. We have managed to gain a foothold in Azerbaijan, Armenia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That is because we offer the latest technology at a reasonable price.
Over 450 domestic and 50 foreign companies are present, offering their latest services and sharing their experiences in workshops held on the sidelines of the exhibition.
We have that digital tools available in the market that are not available here, so we think that that could be beneficial for Iranian companies to use our resources, and we think that we can use the resources Iranian companies have, like their skills in a digital marketplace, the market size and all that stuff.
I didn't know that startup scene here is so is going in good way. We've been in Paradise Technology Park. There is incubators, accelerators. I didn't have idea about that. We are also doing the same things. We can connect on these ideas together, looking for investors, VC funds and startups, and make some good unicorns.
We believe that communication by our countries will be great, will be growth, and we will be nearly than in the past.
ELECOMP is the greatest commercial event in Iran's market of electronics and computer products and services. Since its first edition in 1995, it has been providing a unique opportunity for businesses active in this sector to grow.
As far as the Islamic Republic of Iran is concerned, digital economy is high on the agenda. In a forum of ICT ministers of the member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization, in Tehran, an infrastructure will be set up for the member states to make use of the capacities that are available. Kisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
As polls had largely predicted, the leader of the center-right party New Democracy, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, emerged as the big winner of the repeat elections held in Greece on Sunday after securing a landslide victory on May 21st elections, when the leader of the left-leaning party Syriza was left 20 percentage points behind. Mitsotakis swept once again the parliamentary elections, obtaining over 40% of Sunday's ballot. In the May 21st elections, under a proportional electoral law, the New Democracy leader didn't gather enough votes to win an outright majority. This time, thanks to new election rules, Mitsotakis has been rewarded with a bonus of up to 50 seats, which grants him an absolute majority in the 300-seat Greek parliament.
For the second time in just a few weeks, the citizens have not only told us to continue on the path we set 4 years ago, But they have told us to move faster because the country needs it. Greece is opening a new historic chapter.
During his first term as Prime Minister, Mitsotakis was accused of orchestrating mass wiretaps of lawmakers and journalists and came under heavy criticism following a